the solutions to the ecological challenges we face as we work to create a healthier future for our community and the planet.
Welcome to Eco Radio KC. On today's show, guest Jay Coughlin will join us to discuss the KC plant cleanup, and later we will hear from fellow hosts Richard Mavian and perhaps even Craig Lubo, who are attending the EPA listening session in Lenexa this afternoon. But first, these headlines. Emily DeMarco of Public Source reported Friday that the U.S. Coast Guard, which regulates the country's waterways, will allow shale gas companies to ship fracking wastewater on the nation's rivers and lakes under a proposed policy published Wednesday. The Coast Guard began studying the issue nearly 2 years ago at the request of its Pittsburgh office, which had inquiries from companies transporting Marcellus shale wastewater. If the policy is approved, companies can ship the wastewater in bulk on barges on the nation's 12,000 miles of waterways, a much cheaper mode than trucks or rail. Each barge could transport approximately 10,000 barrels of wastewater over the nation's waterways. Under the policy, companies would first have to test the wastewater at a state-certified laboratory and provide the data to the Coast Guard for review. The tests would determine levels of radioactivity, pH, bromides, and other hazardous materials. In addition, the barges would have to be checked for the accumulation of radioactive particles that might affect workers. If the test results meet the limits outlined in the policy, the companies would receive Coast Guard approval to ship the wastewater in bulk. It is unclear whether the barge companies would self-report the test results. All records outlined in the proposed policy must be held by the barge companies for 2 years, but would be available to the Coast Guard. Normally, the information would also be available to the public under the Freedom of Information Act. However, the policy states that, quote, the identity of proprietary chemicals may be withheld from public release, unquote. Environmental groups, academics, and the media have tried in the past to get information about the chemicals used in fracking. However, gas drilling companies have refused to release the specific amounts of chemicals they pump underground to release gas from the shale formation. Benjamin Stout, a biology professor at Wheeling Jesuit University and a board member of Frack Tracker, a nonprofit that disseminates data about the shale gas industry, said the part of the policy about proprietary chemicals is worrisome to him because it's the easy out, saying that all companies have to do is utter the phrase proprietary information, and then they don't have to worry about releasing information to the public. The gas drilling industry already is exempt from a laundry list of federal regulations, including the Clean Water and Clean Air Acts. The Coast Guard's letter accompanying the proposed policy specifically asks, however, for comment by the public on the disclosure of proprietary information. The full policy can be read on the Coast Guard's website, uscg.mil. The public will have until November 29th to comment. All public comments will be posted at regulations.mil. In other water-related news on this soggy Midwestern day, the Los Angeles Times reported Friday that a new study shows that parts of the Pacific Ocean are absorbing heat faster than they have over the past 10,000 years. The study results, published Friday in the journal Science, suggest that seawater is capturing far more energy than previously thought, for now sparing land dwellers some of the worst effects of climate change. Researchers collected marine sediment off of Indonesia to measure the mineral content in the shells of a species of single-celled plankton that changed their composition as waters warm. In the analysis, scientists reconstructed the temperature of the plankton's habitat in the middle depths of the western Pacific going back 10,000 years. Those waters were cooling gradually until about 1600, when temperatures started inching back up, the study found. In recent decades, the rate of ocean warming has accelerated comparatively quickly, rising about one-third of a degree Fahrenheit in the last 60 years. The timing could be fortuitous, according to Yair Rosenthal, a professor of earth scientists at Rutgers University, because humans may be pumping the atmosphere full of carbon after a naturally occurring cool-down, just when the oceans are most prepared to absorb the heat. Professor Rosenthal was the lead author of the study. He told the LA Times, quote, there may be some hope because maybe the ocean will be able to store more heat than we were estimating before, unquote. It could also spell trouble. While temperatures in the atmosphere go up and down pretty quickly, seawater can absorb a lot of heat before its temperature rises. So even if carbon emissions are reduced, it could take years or even centuries for the ocean to respond, a lag that could have consequences far into the future. The ocean's heat content, which has been measured since the 1960s with buoys and instruments lowered from ships, accounts for about 90% of the Earth's warming, the study says, making it a more reliable indicator of climate change than surface temperatures. Scientists and others have expressed reservations about the pace of warming reported in the study, saying it may be unique to the Western Pacific and fails to account for the cooling and warming of naturally occurring climate patterns like El Niño and the Pacific Decadal Oscillation. Rosenthal acknowledged that the results may not be representative of oceans globally, but said they should raise key questions for other researchers to tackle. One of those, he said, is just how long the ocean can persist as a reservoir for heat, buffering the effects of a warming planet. For more information on any of our stories, find Eco Radio KC on Facebook and Twitter, where we'll post links to some of our sources. While you're visiting, we invite you to like and follow us. We are also now streaming live, and downloadable podcasts of Eco Radio are available at kkfi.org. And now, on with the show. Welcome to Eco Radio KC. On today's show.
All right. And, well, we've got a lot of activity. Thanks for that update, Susan. We've got Jay Coughlin on the line, but we've also got Richard Mabian has just called in. Richard is out at the Environmental Protection Agency's listening session out in Lenexa, Kansas. And this is one of 12 listening sessions being held throughout the country. And Richard told me a little while ago that there were over 400 people there, and they had to split them up into three rooms. And so, Richard, are you there?
Yes, I am, Mike. Can you hear me?
Yeah. So,
okay, good. I got to watch myself because I'm talking to you in a side room just right off from one of the main meeting rooms, so I want to make sure the people out there don't hear my conversation, okay?
Okay. So what do you got to share with us?
Man, this has been quite an experience. From the press conference that we held, the Sierra Club held this afternoon at 3 o'clock, you could say people started showing up out here. I got here myself at about 1 o'clock, and by 1:30 we had a nice-sized group of people starting to form out on the visitors' parking lot. And these people were coming in from St. Louis and Nebraska and Iowa, you know, and the Kansas folks and different parts of Kansas. It was really, really a great atmosphere to be in. Everyone had shirts that they had to put on, so it gave some unity with our group. And then we stood up on the hill and held this big press conference and had three people speaking. Yours truly, of course, you know, got to speak. And that was all before the listening session started. Then we left there and came down and went through that airport-like security to get inside. But once we got inside, the room was just totally full with people, man. And, you know, you got to feel good about that. So these are all people on both sides of the issue now. Everybody there wasn't for it. Some were against this law being passed, this regulation being included, which made it a really American event. I mean, I really felt good being there, pal. People young, old, all different kind of age. Luckily for us, we were able to get some people of color involved from both Kansas City, Missouri and Kansas City, Kansas. Representative Brandon Ellerton showed up, and he spoke and did it very elegantly, as he always does. And we had, I would say, out of Missouri state legislatures, you probably had at least six of them there.
Wow.
I mean, I knew it because I met them through Brandon. So they showed up, and some of them were on both sides of the issue. So it was really a good event. I mean, it's still going on as I'm sitting here talking to you. There's still people that's getting up speaking, but it's really great. Yeah. Any questions from you all?
Yeah. I'm wondering if we lost Jay for a second. So, Ann, maybe you can ask Richard a question while I take this.
Sure, yeah.
Hi, Ann.
Hi, Richard. And so the overall purpose of the EPA listening would be what?
Okay. You know, President Obama passed that made it mandatory that they pass some type of clean Clean Energy Act. He passed the Clean Energy Act, and he wanted them to do something about placing regulations as far as climate control is concerned, okay? So this listening session is EPA wanting to hear from the public on how you feel about them implementing this new standards for clean air. And this should be coming out sometime, like in, I think something in June of 2014. Mm-hmm. So what they're doing is allowing the public the chance to give their opinions on how they feel about them implementing that new act. Some people are against it, some are for it. Mm-hmm. So they all here talking about how they feel. You got some unions that don't want it to happen because they see themselves as losing jobs. Then you got some unions that want it to happen because they see themselves as gaining jobs. So it's been that kind of that flow of conversation all day.
Well, that's interesting. I looked earlier, the Missouri version of Americans for Prosperity, which is a Koch brothers group, had a call on their website for folks to come out and speak against regulation and big government.
Yes.
They
are here doing that. One of the legends, in fact, they have us in threes. They invite us up to the table in threes. Everybody got numbers. When they call your numbers, you go up and speak. And I just got through speaking, and when I spoke, I was sitting at the table with one of those oppositions. I didn't know that when I spoke, but after I got through, I found out he was, and my whole conversation was about the effect that burning coal has on our children, like our young, beautiful children that are growing up in those communities, and how can you place a value on a child's life? That's what I spoke about, and the audience took it very well. They were clapping and stuff. And when I got through, then this guy turned around and started speaking, and it was like he was talking about how it was putting an extra burden on the middle class and blah, 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 blah. So I'm saying you had those kind of comments. That's beautiful, man. That's America at its grandest, if you understand what I'm saying.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you this. Maybe do you a lot of people, you heard a lot of people speak, so maybe you can give maybe one standout thing you heard from each side of the issue, like that people said?
Well, I'm saying that you heard me telling you that the one guy who was opposed to it that was sitting there with me, and he pretty much represents what the negativity that I heard coming from it. It has to do with them seeing it as being an extra burden on middle class because they're going to end up raising the rates when you change to renewable energy, the standard kind of conversation that you hear coming from that. And then again, like I said, you had the union that was pretty much some union workers speaking out thinking that it was going to interfere with their jobs. You know, they saw those jobs leaving. They don't see those kind of jobs that you have in a coal fire plant existing anymore. You switch over to renewable energy. Then when you come back on the positive side, it was more of the air, the effects that the coal burning has on our atmosphere, that it has on our lungs, on our health, on this planet in general. Some one person talked about how the planet will still be here, just won't be any species on the planet from all of the degradation that we're doing coming from fossil fuels. So it was that kind of conversation.
Interesting. And so the EPA has representatives there, and their job is to just take down notes or record whatever.
They're taking notes and recording what's going on. And they switch off. They go from different rooms. A call. Brooks was just in our room, just happened to be in the room when I spoke. But he's going from one of the three rooms, and they have the note takers who are also switching off, going to different rooms. And so they're doing a very good job. I'm very proud of EPA pulling this off. They handle it very professional out here. This is not a junky place to be right now. And you can feel the professionalism that's in the hall.
And before we let you go, I want to get your sense of what, like, you know, is it 50-50 in terms of people there? Is it 54, 50 against, or is it...
No, it's obviously 80-20.
Really?
If that. Oh, yeah. Oh, if that. Yeah, it's a the majority of the people here are for it. And you know, they had even talked on your ground rules, you know, don't be clapping, but that's starting to fade away. You're hearing them clap of certain people by some of the comments that's being made.
Well, how can you not clap if Richard Mabian's speaking?
I wasn't going to say yours truly, but you know they did.
Okay. Richard, before we let you go, since we have Jay on the line, Jay, do you have any questions of Richard about this?
First of all, hello,
no,
Jay.
Not
how you doing, pal?
Say that again, Jay.
I said, no, I don't have any questions at this moment.
Okay. Well, Richard, we're going to let you go, and thanks for that, and hopefully you guys maybe got some recordings. Maybe Craig got something that we could bring
Craig
on here.
Craig got some, and I don't see that particular Craig. He may be in one other room, but one of the Sierra Club guys is making a recording, and I told him we may be able to use that on the air, and he said, great.
Okay.
All right, buddy. Take care.
All right. Okay, thanks.
I might add a couple of comments on the Physicians for Social Responsibility website, psr.org. There is a section on coal, the consequences in terms of asthma, the rates of heart attacks, early death, and also the developmental problems that, you know, the brain abnormalities that come about in children as they're growing up with the mercury that coal plants put out. And the other thing that kind of bridges over into nuclear weapons is that the climate change, the severe weather changes that we're getting with, you know, like the forest fires and the floods and so forth are affecting the nuclear weapons industry and the nuclear energy industry. And Jay can speak to that if he wants to, but there was forest fires that came very, very close to Los Alamos National Lab.
Mm.
Couple of years ago.
Okay, well, we're going to segue into the other portion of our show. And first of all, Jay, thanks for your patience with that. We did need to get that update. That's a very important environmental thing going on right in our backyard. And Jay Coughlin is with Nuke Watch, and he will be in town this week. Giving an address, KC, Linchpin in Nuclear Weapons Production, or 50 Ways to Leave Your Nukes. And he's going to be speaking on Wednesday at All Souls UU Church at 4501 Walnut here in Kansas City, and on Thursday at Walnut Gardens Community of Christ, 19201 Road, R.D. Mize Road in Independence. And I asked Jay, and Ann Solentrop is also here, and Ann is with Physicians for Social Responsibility. And I've asked you both here to, first of all, to get word out about Jay coming to town and to his talk. But also, we here on Eco Radio KC have covered the issue of the Kansas City weapons plant. A lot of folks know who listen to KKFI that the city has gotten involved in this new weapons plant. The city is this quasi-owner that's a big shell game that I don't know that we're going to get into tonight, but certainly you've heard it on Tell Somebody and on Mic Check and many other programs here on Every Woman. It's been we've tried to stay on top of this issue as much as we could. But I want to focus tonight on the old weapons plant, which is at on Bannister Road, just east of Troost, Bannister and Lydia, roughly. And just for the sake of our listeners that may be new to this issue, a little Kansas City Bannister Plant 101. This is a post-war plant. This came about after World War II, and many longtime Kansas City residents might know it as Bendix or Allied Signal, and for the past 20 years or so, Honeywell has been operating this plant for the Kansas City, for the federal government. And it gets a little confusing as to what department. Is it the Department of Energy? Is it the, yeah, it's, Anne's shaking her head, yes. And so, Jay, I wanted to get a sense from you. So this weapons were being made here in the late 40s and into the late 50s. Were there always concerns of environmental concerns there? And I don't mean were people always concerned, because environmental concerns were non-existent back then. But was it fairly innocuous at first, or was it pretty toxic and people just didn't know about it or weren't aware of it?
Well, and as you said, it started out as being a World War II facility for Pratt & Whitney making fighter engines. And back then, as everybody knows, there were hardly any environmental regulations. And besides, a very extremely serious war was going on. So I believe that, you know, pretty much from the beginning, the Kansas City plant site has been contaminated with industrial solvents. And then in time, was, I think in the first half of the 50s, that the predecessor to the Department of Energy, the Atomic Energy Commission, took over the Bannister complex. And from that point on, it, in part, pretty much half of the site, became dedicated to the production of the non-nuclear components for nuclear weapons. And a history of contamination has continued up until this day since then.
So was it always used for, well, I was going to say nuclear weapons, but I guess back then it would have been called atomic weapons. Was that always the purpose of the plant?
Well, as stated, at first, it as a World War II facility, it was building aircraft engines.
So just engines, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, but in the 50s, it was converted by the Atomic Energy Commission into non-nuclear components for nuclear weapons.
Okay, and so I'm curious, I mean, for folks in Kansas City who might be familiar with the area, there is... it's the Little Blue River that runs very close to there. So what's your take? I mean, you talked about in the early, you know, when they were just making the engines, it was just solvents and things like that. Was that river being polluted back then in the late 40s, early 50s?
I believe it was. One thing that is keeping off-site mitigation down is the fact that so much of the site has an impervious surface, you know, whether it's roof or parking lots or what have you, so that rainwater can't enter the ground and essentially recharge the groundwater and therefore drive contaminants off-site. And this is a very important fact that I hope we get into in this conversation. But again, off-site contamination is being held at bay by the fact that rainwater can't really percolate into the ground. But if that site is going to ever undergo serious economic development, requiring demolition of existing structures, that in turn could drive off-site contamination.
And that is what's being talked about, that, I mean, in the vaguest of terms at this point. It's not like there's any plan on the table, or at least not publicly discussed. Is that right?
Well, it's a little bit more solid than that. Is first of all, the particular entity that we're talking about is the National Nuclear Security Administration, a federal entity. And it's a semi-autonomous agency within the Department of Energy. And it's a rather strange and unique site. I can say that across the entire national nuclear weapons complex, that the Kansas City plant is quite unique. The entity that outright owns it and administers it is the General Service Administration, which in turn leases it to NNSA. But it's these two federal agencies that should take responsibility for comprehensive cleanup so that the citizens of Kansas City could really enjoy the economic benefits that would follow from development. But sad to say, in my opinion, the city has been snookered. snickered to issue municipal bonds for a new weapons plant, in effect subsidizing a new plant for the federal government. But I've been saying this for, I don't know, 6 or 7 years now. Watch out, Kansas City. The feds are going to walk away from cleanup. And until the political establishment in Kansas City makes the feds sign up on the dotted line that they're really going to clean up, I think the city of Kansas City is going to end up being burned.
Well, interesting. You have any comments on that, Ann?
Well, there's, you know, about 900 different chemicals that have been listed on the government site that have been used at the Bannister Federal Complex, including depleted uranium. There's beryllium there. It's been reported in the Star at 5 times the level of any other Department of Energy site that makes nuclear weapons. So, you know, the question is, are they going to thoroughly clean this up? Or are they going to let more people come there to work and, you know, suffer the consequences? There's hundreds of workers from not only the part that made nuclear weapons, but also the other workers that worked at GSA that were secretaries and what have you, didn't have anything to do with making nuclear weapons. And they have been sick and dying for years now of very serious cancers, brain tumors, all kinds of things.
Yeah, that's a pretty serious issue, and there's a whole, I mean, KKFI has tried to cover this from many angles, and that's one. I mean, the health issues from the exposure, we've spoken with like Maurice Copeland, who used to work there, and talked about, you know, how people were had to take their coveralls or whatever off before leaving, and there was, you know, a lot of concerns about what they brought home. And in some cases, stuff were, you know, stuff was sent out to dry cleaners, and so did that contaminate, you know, if someone else's clothes if they brought in a suit that day? Or there's a lot of issues coming out of that.
One lady stepped in promethium, which is a radioactive substance, and she's been seriously ill for years.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Really. And so this is part of the nuclear weapons complex that's distributed throughout the United States, but we're told these are the non-nuclear components of those nuclear weapons. But I hear from time to time, there have been nuclear substances on site, either to fix parts, components to, or do you want to speak a little bit about that?
Maurice has said that they did autopsies on weapons that were having problems out in the field, and they would bring them in and cut them open and repair parts of them. So they really didn't know what they were really dealing with. You know, there'd be things oozing and what have you, and so they're not really sure, you know, really what they were dealing with sometimes.
Interesting. So, Jay, you were talking a little bit about, you said you wanted to get into a little bit more about what some of the hazards would be if that was developed. Like, you know, for the mechanics around developing something would be like tearing down things. And so things are pretty much, I don't want to use the word stable, but, you know, things are contained right now. And so breaking apart asphalt or whatever else out there, and there's some concerns that a lot of things would be released. Is that a fair assessment, Jay?
Well, to be accurate about it, release is not quite the right word. Again, if we're removing, I mean, the main building at the plant is something like 3 million square feet. It's just absolutely huge. And, you know, it's under roof, but that by definition is impervious. And how are you going to have people come in and, I don't know, make economic development use of this old 3 million square foot structure? I just think that would be very difficult. But we're facing an ironic situation where to tear things down to prepare things for economic development could be the very thing that begins to drive off-site contamination. And I'm reminded of seeing a development study done by the city itself that was exploring the feasibility of economic development. And if I recall correctly, I don't have it in front of me, but I think this was done in 2007, something like that, 5-6 years ago. And the city noted that the biggest barrier to economic development would be the fact that the site would have to be cleaned up. And then it kind of bemoaned the fact, or it said, basically, and this cleanup might cost $20 million, if I remember correctly, or maybe it's $25 million. But the point that I'm reaching for is that the city was uninformed, and actual costs of cleanup would be on an order of magnitude above that. And again, show me where the feds have signed on the bottom line that they're going to clean that place up. It hasn't happened, and I'm pessimistic that it ever will. So I think this business of economic development will remain a pipe dream until the day that indeed it is cleaned up.
Okay. Ann and I were talking before the show started that it's actually – can you talk a little bit maybe about the Superfund status?
Right. There were 14 Superfund sites on the property. And
14 distinct sites on that. I don't know how big it is. A square mile at most, or more? Is it more than that?
It's huge. I'm not sure exactly how big it is. It's a huge city block, and it's in a flood zone. There's floodgates all around the property. There's plumes underneath the buildings, like 50 feet down, which is filled with VOCs and PCBs, and they are pumped and treated in place right now with a few pumps. And what Jay was talking about is that if the impervious surfaces were removed, the rain would push that plume out to the river. And there's been some cleanup through the years, like during the 80s, and, you know, the EPA actually came into existence in the 70s, 1970 or something. So, you know, there has been some cleanup done, but not near what it should have been.
But I want to go back to this 14 Superfund sites in that small area. So do those sites, they must, first of all, overlap, and second of all, Isn't a Superfund status, isn't that enough to ensure that the federal government is obliged to do something?
Well, there's a list of priorities.
The relevant point, and everybody, is that Kansas City plant in the Bannister Federal Complex was not rated as a Superfund site. And what Ann is referring to is that there were 14 different locations on the complex itself that went through this, it's kind of this ranking scheme in order to determine whether it merits being a Superfund site or not. And first of all, it's kind of funny business that these 14 sites were designated instead of looking at the site as a whole. And it's been a couple of years since I've looked at this, but I would contend that there was definitely a scheme on the part of, and it's EPA, by the way, that does the ranking. And I think there was an intentional effort to kind of play with the numbers and divide and conquer in the sense of focusing on these four sites instead of one integrated site. But again, I believe there was a conscious effort to prevent, you know, totally objective ranking, which I believe would have then resulted in the Kansas City plant and the Bannister Federal Complex as being rated as one single Superfund site.
Which would have elevated its, you know, status,
right,
for
it would have gotten
priority.
It onto the list of priorities, and that would have made it more likely to get funding to actually get cleaned up. So instead of that, the EPA and the Missouri Department of Natural Resources have joined forces and they're going to oversee the cleanup, and they've put it under one law, RCRA, I believe, to get it cleaned up to some degree, and I understand that CenterPoint is going to be in charge of that.
So explain to us a little bit about CenterPoint's role in this whole scheme of things. They're involved in the new weapons plant, right?
Right.
So what's their deal?
Want to take that one, Jay?
Well, first of all, it's a partnership involved in the new plant and now the old plant. And it's a partnership of Zimmer Real Estate Services, the local real estate magnate there. And then CenterPoint, which is from near Chicago. Earlier I remarked how unique the situation is with the Kansas City plant. And by that I mean both the old and new plant. But the site of the new plant just happened to be owned by Zimmer. And, you know, I'm putting just happened to be in air quotes. What a coincidence. And then across the highway from the new site, CenterPoint was developing the old Air Force field there in location as an intermodal transportation center for, you know, what people refer to as the NAFTA highway. So there's already a nexus of interest with CenterPoint and Zimmer, and then they formed a partnership and won this purchase to lease for the new site. Now, subsequently, I'm not sure what the bidding process was, but the National Nuclear Security Administration, the federal agency within the Department of Energy that owns the Kansas City plant, that half of the Bannister complex, they have gone through this process of making a formal determination that final disposition, that's the term that is used, the final end state of the old complex, of the old plant, will be to transfer it to the private sector. And then I'm not exactly clear on how CenterPoint Zimmer gained control of that, but they too will end up developing the old site. But again, I stress, I'm not aware of any concrete cleanup mechanisms or actions that are about to take place. And again, I just don't think the Bannister complex can be feasibly economically developed and be of real benefit to the local citizens until it's cleaned up.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break here, play a couple of messages, and then when we come back, I want to maybe talk about what, you know, folks who are listening or who are concerned about this, how they can get involved. So we'll be back in just a minute.
Turning combat boots into plowshares. As part of the retirement of the American Friends Service Committee's Missouri and Kansas Eyes Wide Open exhibits, the American Friends Service Committee, Vets for Peace, and Artists Helping the Homeless will distribute over 200 combat boots to homeless veterans and other homeless area residents on Sunday, November 10th from 4:30 to 5:30 at Mill Creek Park, 47th Street and Main Street. For further information, contact the American Friends Service Committee at 816-931-5256. The preceding message is a public service announcement of 90.1 KKFI FM, Kansas City Community Radio.
Americans traditionally don't know a lot about our South American neighbors. On Wednesday's All Souls Forum, we're going to hear from a missionary who spent considerable time in Bolivia and other parts of South America. His name is Father Michael Gilgannon. Please join us to hear what he has to say Wednesday at 6 p.m. right here on KKFI's All Souls Forum.
All right, we're back. And Jay, while we had the mics off, Ann was telling me that I really need to brag about you a little bit, about what a champion you've been in this field, dealing with holding the nuclear weapons complex accountable in many ways for over a quarter century now. So do you feel optimistic about that? Do you feel like that, you know, not just talking about Kansas City, but in the grand scheme, in the global scheme of things, do you feel like you've made some headway, or what's your take on that?
Oh, I definitely feel like I've made headway, and I don't want to personalize it with just me. I think the world has made significant progress. You know, if we play it by the numbers, 30 years ago, we had some 70,000 weapons at one time in a total stockpile. And the same is, you know, roughly true for the Soviet Union as well. So we've at least gone down from these just mind-numbingly large stockpiles, again, on the order of around 70,000 apiece. And now we're down to something like 10,000. And by that, I'm talking total stockpile, reserve, those that are waiting in the queue to be dismantled, et cetera, et cetera. But I do take heart in that. Like Martin Luther King stated, I steal his phrase, but, you know, the long arc of history bends towards justice, and I'd like to appropriate that and say I think the long arc of history leads to the eventual abolition of nuclear weapons. But it's going to have to be done smartly. I'm the last person to say that we should do it unilaterally. And to invoke the darling of conservatives, Reagan, you know, trust but verify. But we'll get there someday. And I'm actually of the opinion that we, the world, will end up getting rid of nuclear weapons, or they'll get rid of us one of these days.
Interesting. And so I do want to ask, I guess, a two-party question. One, how can people assist you folks in getting rid of nuclear weapons, but also what can people do specifically about the cleanup, you know, of the old site?
Well, the place I start, and you referred to the fact that I've been doing this for, you know, it's getting close to a quarter century. Now, people are very cynical about Congress, and Lord knows that there is much reason to be cynical. Mm-hmm. But I urge citizens to really pressure their congressional delegation. I go to Washington, you know, close to six times a year or something like that, and I do pace the halls of Congress every now and then. I just think it's vital. It's vital that citizenry keep the pressure on their congressional delegation. To be fair to the members of Congress, they got a lot coming at them, and a lot of that are the interests that are largely economic and would tend to drown out the best interests of the public, is the way I would put it. And I think that Kansas City is a glaring example where, again, you had the municipal government help a federal agency build a federal nuclear weapons production center. Well, mark my words, the city is going to get burned on cleanup. The feds are going to walk away from cleaning up the old site. So they'll grab that new production plant, but the feds will walk away from their moral responsibility to clean up the old site. And I think local Kansas City citizens should be pounding on the door of Congress to rectify that injustice.
Well, let me ask you both something about trying to get a sense of the lay of the land. Congressman Cleaver, who, if I understand correctly, is a former employee of, I guess it was Bendix back then, has been a proponent of going forward with the new plant because of the jobs and perceived economic benefit and all that. Do you have a sense of where he stands on the cleanup of the old plant?
Well, I have yet to meet a member of Congress that will explicitly say that they're against cleanup. And generally, you know, members of Congress are going to be in favor of anything that brings money to their district, whether it's for weapons or whether it's for cleanup. But what I would take issue with is whether the congressional delegation really makes the effort, you know, puts their shoulders to the wheel to bring the level of funding needed for cleanup. And I point to the obvious. Times are tough right now. There are a lot of federal budget constraints, as there should be, in my opinion. We do have to begin to lower the federal debt, et cetera, et cetera. But we don't necessarily know that times will get better, and for the sake of posterity, we should be cleaning up now and not later.
Good point. Good point. Our time, this is really going fast, and I'm really appreciating the depth we're able to go into in this. I don't want to get too far without mentioning your trip to town, and so maybe, Ann, maybe you can share the specifics again about where that is, and then maybe share websites or where,
right.
If people don't have a pen in hand, they at least can remember a website. But give us the...
These are a couple of talks that are free. They're open to the public. They're sponsored by PeaceWorks, and the talks will be the same, basically. So if you miss one, you could go to the other. Wednesday, November 6th, 7 p.m., at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church, and that's at 45th and Walnut, Kansas City, Missouri. And then the next night it would be Thursday, November 7th at 7 p.m., and that's at Walnut Gardens Community of Christ. And the address is 19201 R.D. Mize Road in Independence. And Jay is going to be talking about the cleanup at the old plant, but also he'll be talking about the new plant and life extension programs, or LEPs. And this is the schemes that keep the money rolling into the nuclear weapons complex. And there are 8 major sites to it, and in Kansas City is one of those 8.
Really?
Mm-hmm. And we're heavily involved in the life extension programs.
I'd like to point out that Kansas City is the Kansas City plant is in a league unto itself. It's by far the most productive of the 8 nuclear weapon sites that Ann just mentioned. But it is the site that makes it happen, cranking out on the order of 100,000 components a year for nuclear weapons. There's no other site like it.
Wow. So let me ask you that. That leads to another question. Like, what's going on right now? I mean, since we're transitioning from one plant to another, is there any downtime, or is there slowing down, or where are they being built right now? Still at the old plant, at the new plant, both?
Well, there's no real slowdown, and my understanding is that they're moving operations incrementally from the old site to the new site. So, no, there shouldn't be any significant slowdown in the production of nuclear weapons components. And as Ann indicated, Kansas City plant is very involved in what's called these life extension programs for existing weapons. And I'm the first to say that our weapons need to clearly need to be maintained until the day that we're finally able to get rid of them. But what these life extension programs are doing are another matter entirely, radically changing or introducing major changes to existing weapons when our existing stockpile has been tested over 1,000 times, is known to be reliable. My point there is that all this make-work could actually undermine national security by eroding confidence in stockpile reliability. And finally, I'd like to point out that at the same time that the production complex and the nuclear weapons labs make all this work for themselves, they're also introducing new military capabilities to existing weapons. Contrary to what is declared policy at the highest levels of government and repeated to the international delegations. So clearly I have quite a dim view of these life extension programs, and instead want to argue for just conservative and prudent maintenance that is technically less risky and clearly less of a cost to the taxpayer. And that's part of what I'd like to talk about this coming Wednesday and Thursday.
All right. And then I guess one other question. What do you guys, what's best case scenario for the old plant? Like what should happen with it? Should it be roped off and left for eternity or cleaned up? Or I mean, obviously it should be cleaned up, but beyond that.
Well, if I was king of the hill, to have it thoroughly cleaned up, to dig up the soils that are needed that are contaminated with volatile organics, that is to say solvents, and the PCBs. There's actually maps that exist of the underground plumes, and they are pretty large. And unlike where I live here in New Mexico, the water table is within 30 feet of the surface or so. And once again, they could migrate to both the Blue River and Indian Creek if rainwater is allowed to recharge. So you're asking me what would be ideal. I say comprehensive cleanup, which will always have that wonderful side benefit of creating numerous high-paying jobs. It's a real win-win. Clean up and protect the environment while creating jobs.
Tom Clemmer just posted on Eco Radio's Facebook page. He says, the EPA press release September 2011 about avoiding Superfund NPL status for Bannister Federal Complex. If the permit modifications are approved, EPA Region 7 will defer moving forward with actions to place the complex on the Superfund National Priorities List. Regulations allowing such deferrals with the expectation that a site will receive attention more quickly than it otherwise would, while providing an appropriate mechanism to assess issue performance cleanups. The NPL deferral will remain in place until all obligations under the permit modifications are completed. And that's thanks to Tom, host of Tell Somebody, for that update.
Well, towards that end, again, I state I'm not aware of any cleanup contemplated. It's the public should know there will be ongoing monitoring. There will be ongoing pump and treat of groundwater. And that, at this point, is expected to, you know, have to continue into perpetuity instead of actually going in and cleaning up and removing the contaminated soils. So this is typical across the country where you have the semi-independent agency within the Department of Energy, the National Nuclear Security Administration, but I should actually expand this to Department of Energy as well. But they're always looking for cleanup on the cheap, and a lot of it is what I would call bureaucratic cleanup, where under existing law, they can actually designate it as cleaned up as a legal matter, when the reality is there's still much left in the way of contaminants. So there's a lot of bureaucratic, you know, loopholes, et cetera, et cetera. And the proof is in the pudding. Let's see some real cleanup. Let's see the feds commit to that. And we must have the Missouri and the Kansas City, or excuse me, and Kansas State delegation as well. But we should have both congressional delegations leaning heavily on the federal government to provide the needed funding for cleanup so that the citizens of Kansas City can really enjoy the benefits of economic development at the old Bannister site.
All right. Jay Coghlan with NukeWatch.org and Ann Sullenchop with Physicians for Social Responsibility. We're out of time, but thank you so much for sharing what you know about this very important issue.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right.
Thank you.
And now for tonight's calendar. Lots of stuff going on this week. Tomorrow at 5:30 p.m., KC Food Not Lawns is hosting a happy hour gathering in the side room between McCoy's and the Foundry, located on the corner of Westport Road and Pennsylvania in Westport. Steve Mann will show how replacing the lawn in your front and backyard can help you grow your own food and create a community, not just a neighborhood. Local food security is just one of the many reasons why you might want to hear about this movement. Find more information at foodnotlawnskc.org. On Thursday from 3:30 to 6 p.m., the Mid-America Regional Council, or MARC, will host a public meeting to review the policy framework of Transportation Outlook 2040, the Metropolitan Transportation Plan for the Kansas City region. MARC updates this long-range plan every 5 years. Area residents will have the opportunity to review the 9 goals in the plan, which ultimately guide how transportation funds are spent in the Kansas City region, and current progress toward those goals. Transportation Outlook 2040 captures the vision for long-range transportation strategies and investments, defines ways to implement plans, and sets the standard for projects that seek federal transportation funds. The plan update is a 14-month process coordinating with area planners, elected officials, agencies, and citizen input to establish a vision for what the region will look like and what should be important for the region over the next 3 decades. The Mid-America Regional Council is at 600 Broadway, Suite 200, KCMO. More information is available at t2040.org. You may also submit your ideas by email to transportation@marc.org. Please include TO2040 in the subject line. This Saturday from 9 a.m. to noon, the Kansas City Community Garden's Get Growing team will host a workshop teaching how to start a community garden, sharing knowledge which is essential for anyone thinking of starting a community garden or wanting to expand or improve their existing one. Free and open to the public, the workshop will be at the Kansas City Community Garden's main site, 6917 Kensington in KCMO. To register, call 816-931-3877. The City of Lawrence will be hosting an electronics recycling event on Saturday from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the Free State High School North parking lot, 4700 Overland Drive in Lawrence. Electronic devices typically contain toxic heavy metals like lead, mercury, and cadmium, and precious metals like silver and gold. If recycled properly, these metals can be feedstock for new industrial processes, not to mention saving production costs and keeping them out of the landfill. This event will provide Lawrence residents and businesses a way to conveniently recycle old, unwanted electronics equipment. Items accepted for recycling are computer monitors, desktops, laptops, keyboards, printers, and other peripherals, televisions, copiers, scanners, telephones, cell phones, pagers, fax machines, VHS and DVD drives, handheld devices, and small appliances like microwave or toaster ovens. There is a $15 recycling fee for CRT televisions under 27 inches and a $35 fee for CRT televisions over 27 inches, all big screen TVs, and all console TVs. There are no charges for other electronic equipment. Items not accepted are large appliances such as refrigerators and AC units and household hazardous waste such as compact fluorescent lights or compressed gas cylinders. Fees may be paid by cash or check. On Sunday at 4 p.m., the Kansas Permaculture Collaborative will hold a seasonal meeting and potluck. This will be the seasonal meeting of permaculture enthusiasts to share ideas, do file swaps, compare notes on nursery suppliers, make plans for collaborating in the upcoming year, and more. Bring a potluck dish and something to drink, and wear warm clothes for gathering around a bonfire after dinner. The event will be held at the Herstead Homestead, 13080 230th Street in Linwood, Kansas. Next Monday from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m., Bridging the Gap and the Environmental Excellence Business Network are hosting their year-end social at Boulevard Brewery with libations, Waldo pizza, and drawings. Capacity is limited. A link to RSVP can be found at bridgingthegap.org. And next Tuesday, November 12th, from 6:30 to 8 p.m., Village Presbyterian Church will host a workshop examining agricultural water issues in Kansas, discussing how climate change is beginning to affect the availability of agricultural water in Kansas. As reduced rainfall and hotter temperatures become the new normal, can an increasingly depleted Ogallala Aquifer continue to sustain Kansas agriculture as it is currently practiced? How can water be more judiciously allocated? Will perennializing annual crops make them more drought-resistant? What about the implications of hydraulic fracking on fresh water supply? Village Presbyterian Church is at 6641 Mission Road in Prairie Village, Kansas. There is a flat enrollment fee which allows you to take as many courses as you wish in a semester. To enroll in a course, visit villagepres.org. Send an email to marianne.weber@villagepres.org or call 913-671-2333.